1 Peter 1:13 through 1:25. The third talk in a series on 1 Peter was presented by Peter Wieringa on July 8, 2007 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Good morning, everybody. We're going back to 1 Peter. A couple weeks ago started a short series in 1 Peter, and as I have opportunity from time to time to teach, I'll go back to 1 Peter, but I wanted to be working through a book to be able to take things just a step at a time and see what that particular author had to say in the letter that he had written, one of the letters that he had written. So we're going to be going back this morning to 1 Peter. We're going to be looking at chapter 1, verses 13 through 25, through the end of that chapter. But before getting started, I wanted to go back and give you a little bit of introduction to this topic, because it's a little bit of a tricky subject to be covering what Peter was covering in this passage. It's a little bit of a tricky subject to be covering that here with this group. And let me tell you why. In the years that we have been around this group, whether it's Gutenberg College, McKenzie Study Center, Reformation Fellowship, we started hanging around with you folks some 7-8 years ago when our oldest child came to Gutenberg. We found ourselves very attracted to this group of people, to the sorts of things that were being discussed here, were being taught. We found ourselves moving here in order to be more a part of what is going on here. And one of the reasons, probably the main reason, that we wanted to be a part of things here is because, in my mind, this group, and I include all of you, it's the folks that have been teaching you, that have helped to direct this over the last 25 years or so. But I think of all of you when I say that this group has, in my mind, in a very unique way, gotten a handle on what is really important about the gospel, gotten a handle on what it means to strip away and to get rid of some of the superfluous things, some of the things that aren't necessary, able to see with a lot of clarity what so much of us in the church these days, what so much is put forth as being important to the gospel that really is not important to the gospel, or being an essential message of the gospel that really isn't an essential message. And this group, I think, has very uniquely, at least in our experience, been able to really pare that down to the essentials and to what really is critical and get to the heart of what the gospel is all about. So I appreciate that about this group very much. But what that means is that a lot of the things that are often talked about in other churches, and I would say a lot of those things are sort of the easy topics, and I'll help you understand in a minute what I mean by that. A lot of the things that are talked about in other churches really are not talked about very much here, because what is focused on are the essential aspects of what it means for me as an individual to know who God is, to pursue who God is, to seek to understand what the Scriptures have to say, and to focus in on that in such a way that we set aside a lot of the trappings, a lot of the external things that so often characterize the life of the believer and that so often have been the things that traditionally have been meant to characterize the life of the believer. Just examples. As I was growing up, my father was a pastor in the Reformed Church in America, a good conservative denomination. And as I was growing up, it was unheard of to go play baseball or to go swimming on Sunday afternoon. I mean, it was just unheard of. Now, my folks, I would have to say, really had a balanced, for the most part, a balanced understanding of what was going on. And so I actually did eventually get to go play baseball. But if my grandma knew about it, we all would have been in trouble. That was sort of the tradition that I grew up in, where there were certain external behaviors that people thought to be a gauge of whether or not one was truly a believer. Well, here with this group, the focus is on what's going on the inside, what's truly going on with one's relationship with God, and then people are left to sort through, to a very large degree on their own, to sort through exactly what that means. And that's right, that's fitting, that's appropriate, because it's going to look different for each individual out there. How that's expressed in my life, what that looks like in my life, is going to be different from what it looks like in your life. So that's an appropriate way to approach things. But with some, just a bit of fear and trepidation, I get into the passage that we're looking at here in 1 Peter, because in this passage, Peter seems to be zeroing back in some respects, zeroing back in on some of the external things that are easy targets for a sermon in any church in America. But what Peter is saying, what he wants us to remember, what he wants us to focus on, is that as believers, our lives are in fact different than, for the most part, than those who are outside the church. Now, I'm going to spend a lot of time elaborating on that thought this morning, because that's a tricky thing to talk about. It's real easy to suggest, as many folks do, it's real easy to suggest that somehow or other our behavior is going to be a measure of how mature we are. Or somehow or other it is our behavior that will merit God's grace in our lives. I don't want to go there. I don't believe that. I don't think that. I wouldn't want to suggest that. But the passage that we're looking at here today drives me to have to talk about some things that aren't things that perhaps I would normally bring up in the course of a Bible study. That's what's nice about the type of teaching that's done around here when one teaches through a book of the Bible. The nice part is that we don't, when we do that, we don't pick topics that we can aim at certain people or certain situations in the congregation, which is not all that uncommon out there. Rather, we are driven to what we're going to talk about by what the authors of the New Testament are talking about, what they're concerned about, what they're saying, and hopefully then we are seeing things from their perspective and expressing the sorts of things that they would express. One of the reasons that this is an interesting topic for me right now is because we have found, and some of you will look at us and say, well, obviously Peter and Case are just getting old, because the older I get, I'll tell you quite honestly, the more and more I wonder if I sound like my parents or even my grandparents before them, because the older we get, the more we look around at society and we say, you know what? Things aren't going so well in society. And in many respects, those of you who have lived in Eugene for a long time maybe have lost sight of really, in many respects, how different things are here in Eugene. There's a remnant of the culture of the 60s that just won't go away. It was a year or two ago. I don't remember which of my siblings it would have been, but somebody, my siblings, or it might have even been my mother-in-law, I don't remember. We had some family in visiting, and what do you do on the weekend when you have family visiting town? You go to Saturday Market, of course. That's what you do. So we went to Saturday Market with some family members, and there's a woman parading around with a sandwich board. You know what those are? It's the thing that two sides to it, shoulder straps, and there's a message on it. And there was some profound political message that was on the sandwich board. But it was kind of hard to pay attention to the message because she had on the sandwich board and not much else parading around Saturday Market. Well, Obviously, that's just a minor thing, but we live. I'm gonna generalize much more broadly now. We live in America today in a very permissive society. We live in a society where, and here I'm going to start to sound really old, but we live in a society where the movies that we go to see now commonly are the sorts of movies that just a few decades ago would have been considered pornographic. And the R-rated movies, those that are R-rated for sexual content, are the movies that just a few decades ago would have been considered triple X pornographic. That's the reality, and that's where I start to sound old, because it has become so common in our culture today to just think nothing of that sort of thing. The television shows that find their way into our living rooms and family rooms 24 hours a day are full of content that just, again, a few short years ago, it would have been unthinkable to have put that sort of content in front of families, in front of young children. We have, in our society, we have sexual promiscuity lived out in a far more rampant way than was. And I mean, I lived in the 50s and 60s. I don't think I'm just idealizing it. I think things really are different than they were 30, 40, 50 years ago. That's 50 years ago now. That's a long time. But the reality is, sexual promiscuity is much more rampant inside and outside the church. Sex outside of marriage is much more common than it was before. So we really do live in a society where morality, behavior continues to decline. Now, I don't think that we're the only society that has lived in decline. I don't think that God has somehow or other lost control, and that somehow or other we're on a freight train over which even God has no say about what will go on or anything like that. I'm simply observing that in our society, things are not going well as far as morality is concerned. And that's what you're getting at here, is that in the passage that we're looking at in 1 Peter, I think Peter is driving us to talk some about morality when he talks about how important it is for us to be holy, when he talks about how important it is for us to be obedient, for us to turn away from the lusts of the Gentiles, that sort of thing. So all of this is in just an introduction to the topic that I think Peter wants us to be paying attention to in the letter that he wrote. Well, here in this section, 1 Peter, like I said, we find lots of talk about obedience. We find him discussing holiness, things like that. If we go back to last week, my introduction to the book, as we looked at the first 12 verses or so of 1 Peter, I think that Peter helps to set the stage for this in verse 2, in his first two introductory verses, when he talks about those who are chosen. That's at the end of verse 1. He talks about those who are chosen, and then he says a couple of things, four things that characterize those who are chosen. And the way I see what he is expressing there in verse 2, I see that he has a couple of bookends. He talks about the fact that individuals are chosen based on the foreknowledge of God the Father. That's for all time and eternity. From the beginning of time, God has known those whom he would choose. So that's one bookend. I think the other end of the bookend is when he talks about, and I retranslated some of this for you last week, when he talks about the fact that we have been sprinkled with his blood, those who have been chosen have been sprinkled with his blood, I think that he's simply using that as a way to describe those who in fact will experience life in the age to come. The phrase that Jack uses, will experience salvation. That's what I think he means when he talks about those who have been sprinkled with his blood. So on one side, he talks about those who have been foreknown. On the other end, he talks about those who will, in fact, having been foreknown, will, in fact, experience life in the age to come. And in the middle, Then he talks about two other things. In the middle, he talks about those who have been sanctified or are being sanctified, have been consecrated, are being made holy in the Spirit. And I talked about the fact that it wasn't clear to me in that verse if it was referring to being sanctified, us being sanctified in our spirits, or if it was the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit, who was doing the sanctifying. And in reality, it doesn't really matter to me which he's talking about there. The reality is he's talking about being sanctified, being consecrated, set apart, being made holy. So he talks about that, and he talks about becoming obedient. So the way I see his introduction, he is assuming that we all need to understand that what it means to be chosen is that God has foreknown us, God will save us, and in the process, in between, in that time frame in which we are living right now, in between, we are being sanctified, we are being made holy, we're being set apart, and we're becoming obedient. And for I think for Peter, those were very important things for him to be reminding them of. I'm imagining what it must have been like for Peter, a fisherman from Galilee, as he found himself traveling around much of the known world, and as he found himself encountering things that were very foreign to him, a lot like going to Saturday Market for the first time or something like that, encountering things that are just very different. Well, for Peter, then, he understands, and he spends a lot of time, I think, in 1 Peter, a lot of time really focusing on the fact that our lives now are different than they were before we became Christians. Well, over the last couple of months, we spent quite a bit of time in a study in Galatians on Sunday evening. Some of us were going over to Jack's house every other week studying Galatians, and part of our discussion during that time was to talk about what it means to be saved, what salvation is all about. And we talked about some things, we talked about a whole lot of things, but right in the middle of that, we were talking a little bit about what the Christian life, well, I'm trying to figure out the best way to phrase this, talking about what changes there were in the life of the believer. And I'm going to try to represent as best I can some of the things that we talked about. If I mischaracterize it, Jack can jump up and correct me here, or somebody else who was at that Galatians study. But we talked about a couple things. First of all, we talked about the fact that when one becomes a believer, I am not suggesting that somehow or other we become in any sense morally perfect. That is not going to happen. That is not God's plan for this life. That is not the reality of our lives. It is not going to happen. I'm not suggesting even that it's God's intention. Well, I'll get into that topic a little bit later. But we're not going to become perfect. We are not going to be sinless. There will be times in our life when we continue to disobey, but the general course of our life, the general trajectory of our life, is that we will, in fact, be understanding more and more of what obedience and holiness are all about. And let me quote a little bit from some of the things that we talked about with regard to righteousness, goodness, when we were in that Galatians study a couple months ago. We talked about the fact that that what happens with the believer is that there is, and I'm going to quote here just from some of the notes that we took and some of the things that we came up with. For the believer, there is in fact an inner holiness or righteousness which is given by God, but which is not true and perfect goodness. And that's important to understand that distinction, because when I talk about sanctification, when I talk about holiness, I don't want you to flip a switch and say, oh, he is telling me the same thing I've always been told, that somehow or other the expectation is that for a believer I will now live a perfect life. That's not what I'm saying. There is for the believer now an inner holiness or righteousness which is given by God, which is not true and perfect goodness. It is not moral perfection of one's entire moral being. Rather, it is an inner righteousness which makes one able and willing to, quote, keep the Mosaic covenant in a way that one has not been, one who has not been made holy or sanctified by God's grace, that individual is not able or willing to keep that covenant. I don't want you to get confused by the wording at the end there. Basically, what we were talking about is that there is some change that takes place. And I think where we sometimes go astray is when we think that once we become believers, it's simply a matter of a different understanding and a different way of thinking, and that's it. A different understanding, a different way of thinking is fundamental to who we are as believers. A different orientation to who God is fundamental to who we are as believers. But there are other changes that that take place as well, and those are the things that I think Peter is driving at in the passage that we're looking at today. So what I'm saying is that with belief, I believe, I'm suggesting that something significant has changed in the life of the believer. I would even go so far as to say, I think that there are other passages, and I would specifically suggest Romans 6, other passages that are going to call into question if, in fact, one's behavior, conduct, life has not changed at all, then there would have to be, that individual would have to begin to question whether or not they were, in fact, a believer. Because with that reorientation, in fact, comes a change in our conduct, a change in our life. Well, the verses we're studying today then start with that assumption that that the life of the believer, I think, will be different than the life of the non-believer. And just let me wrap up with just another thought that is going to go through the passage that we're looking at here in 1 Peter. But before I specifically get into these verses, what I want to just note for you is there's a family of words that is used here in this passage and is used throughout the New Testament that I just want to tell you a little bit about so you can be thinking about it, so you can keep it in mind as you're reading through the New Testament. And it's a family of words that has to do with the concept of holiness, sanctification. The reason I bring it up is because in this family of words, it is often translated one way in the verb form to mean sanctify and or to mean consecrate, set apart, something like that. But in the noun form or as an adjective, especially as an adjective when it's used as a noun, it's translated holy, or what I find very interesting is how often it's translated saints. The word hagios is the word that means holy. It's used 222 times in the New Testament. Different words in that word family. The verb form is hagiazo. In 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 2, when it talked about, the New American Standard says, the sanctifying work of the Spirit. When I translated that, the consecration or sanctification of spirit, that's another word in that word family, hagiasmos. So that word family is used often, but the word hagias is used numerous times throughout the New Testament. When it talks about the Holy Spirit, the word hagias is used to describe the Spirit. When it talks about God being holy, that word is used. And so there are times that that word clearly denotes moral perfection. It clearly denotes a characteristic of God by which he is known for how different he is than us and for, in fact, his moral perfection. But then what is fascinating to me is that the New Testament writers have this irritating habit of referring to us as believers as the holy ones. It's taking that that adjective, using it as a noun, and it's usually translated in the New Testament as saints. Most of the time, probably perhaps even all the time, when you see the word saints in the New Testament, it's the word holy. It's simply that adjective that's used as a noun there. So there's this irritating habit that the New Testament writers have of referring to, using the same word to describe who God is and using that same word to describe who we are as the saints. Now, we all know from our own experience, as well as looking at those around us, we all know that when that word is used to describe believers, it does not describe moral perfection. It does not describe some sort of unattainable ideal. But I do think it describes a change of direction that happens in the life of the believer. I do think that it's meant to describe that, in fact, our lives are to be different than those of the non-believers around us. Well, by talking about that word family, my goal isn't to sort of narrow down the range of meaning and give you the secret meaning to those words that really unlocks everything. My goal is simply to let you know that those are the words that are used a lot of different ways. And it, for me, what that does is that opens up a range of understanding that concept that perhaps I didn't have before. It helps me to understand that when I'm talking about sanctification in the life of the believer, it isn't with the expectation that there will be ultimate perfection, ultimate goodness that characterizes the life of the believer. But it also does indicate, in my mind, that there is, in fact, a change in our direction, a change in our life. Now I'm going to switch gears a little bit and put on my history teacher hat. I studied history when I was in college. It's always been a great love of mine. And I'm going to give you just a little snippet of history here, because we in the church in America in the 21st century now, we are heirs of what has been going on throughout the history of the church in America for the last several hundred years. And what I'm going to tell you is that I think that back in the early 1800s, there was a movement within the church in America that in my mind came to dominate most of our understanding of what sanctification and holiness are all about. Those of you who sat in on the church history class, this will be some repetition, but back in the early 17th century, there was a revival in America called the Great Awakening. Then in the early 19th century, beginning right around 1800, 1801, there was the Second Great Awakening, which was a revival movement both in the Northeast as well as in the South, out onto the frontier. Now, it's so weird for us to think about it in these terms, but the frontier in 1800 was Tennessee and Kentucky. That was the frontier in those days, because that was about as far west as they had gone at that point. But there was this revival movement really all across the country at that point that was very different from the revival movement 60, 70 years earlier. The revival movement in the early 1800s was characterized by Methodism becoming established as a denomination at that point, but Methodism really more as a movement that it's a name that was given to a movement that was part of what John and Charles Wesley and several others were a part of, beginning over in England back in the 18th century. The Wesleys lived 60, 70 years earlier than this. But there was a theological and a church movement known as Methodism that absolutely swept America during the Second Great Awakening. And what's worth noting is that Methodism really was the idea, the way of thinking, that there were certain things that we needed to do in order to be holy. Methodism, in that day, in that context, really was taking the internal and making it external in a way that over time it became just external rather than having the same internal component. John and Charles Wesley, when they went to Oxford in the early 1700s, around 1740, I don't remember just when it was, while they were at Oxford, and I get a kick out of this. I think it's funny the things that come down in history. While they were at Oxford, the Wesleys were part of the Holy Club. We didn't have one of those at UC Santa Barbara. I don't know why, how we missed on that, but at Oxford in the 1700s, they were part of the Holy Club. And I'm going to quote from Justo Gonzalez's textbook, The Story of Christianity. They were members of the Holy Club whose, quote, whose members made a covenant to lead a holy and sober life, to take communion at least once a week, to be faithful in their private devotions, to visit the prisons regularly, and to spend 3 hours together every afternoon studying the Bible and books of devotion. Well, now I know why we didn't have that at Santa Barbara. But that mentality, that way of thinking and doing things, characterized Methodism, and it was the idea that focusing on those externals. Now, don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with 3 hours of Bible study and devotion a day. There's nothing wrong with praying. There's nothing wrong with taking communion. There's nothing wrong with those things. But with Methodism, with the Wesleys in particular, the focus changed, and I don't think it was their intention. I'm quite sure it wasn't, but the focus changed over time from what God was doing in the life of the individual, from the change of direction, from the change of priorities that God brings about in the life of the individual. The focus was switched from that to these particular external behaviors that are characteristics of the believer. And so since that time, I think that the church in America has suffered from this idea that those are the things that define whether or not one is a believer. Quite apart from what God is doing internally, quite apart from what's happening inside, all we need to do is see how they behave, see what sorts of activities they engage in, see what they're doing to understand whether or not they're believers. And that is what we are trying so hard to fight against at this point. Because at that point, Christianity, belief, a relationship with God, has been reduced to just those externals and becomes detached from what God's really doing. What I'm suggesting to you is that with Methodism, with the Second Great Awakening, with that absolutely sweeping the country in the early 1800s, that then set the stage for the direction that so many of our churches have gone, so much of conservative Protestantism has gone in America since that time. And it really fit well with Americans, because in America, we're very self-reliant. We're very convinced that we can do things on our own, so it really fits with the character of Americans to think that, likewise with the Christian life, it's just a matter of my getting a handle on what has to be done, and then I can do it. That's the way we think as Americans. Well, that obviously is not what the New Testament thinks about biblical belief, about true belief, but that has characterized, I think, come to characterize much of the church today. Well, now, after all that, we're actually going to get into the passage. We're looking at 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 13 through 25. And I actually think that much of what I had to say, lest you be confused, is in this passage, came out of the discussions in this passage. But Peter says some interesting things here, starting off in verse 13. And again, I like the New American Standard, because when they translate something differently, they let you know. But I also find myself growing increasingly frustrated sometimes with the New American Standard, because there can tend to be some confusion and some minor things with the way they translate things. Here in verse 13, let me just read this a couple of verses here to you, and then we'll go back and talk about it. Peter says, "Therefore, gird your minds for action, keep sober in spirit, fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance, but like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior, because it is written, 'You shall be holy, for I am holy.'" Well, now you know why that massive introduction I gave to you, because Peter says some things here that are hard words for us to really get a handle on and really understand what he's saying. He's making some pretty strong claims here on how we're to live our lives. When he tells us to be holy as just like the Holy One who has called you to be holy ourselves, for as it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. When he tells us to be obedient children, he's making some pretty strong claims here on how he wants us to live. Well, let me just make some observations as we go through here. First of all, there are two errors that I think we need to avoid. One is the error that I've talked about already of thinking that somehow or other it is our behavior that defines our relationship with God, and to somehow or other mistakenly think that our personal goodness or our personal righteousness are the things that make us acceptable to God. That's an error on one side. And on the other side, I would say the other error that we need to avoid is to think that if, in fact, that isn't true, well, then my behavior doesn't matter. I think the New Testament takes us down a middle path where the reality is that our behavior doesn't define our relationship with God, but that doesn't mean that our behavior and our lifestyle and our conduct doesn't matter. Peter tells here the people to whom he's writing, those who reside as aliens throughout the area of Pontus, Galatia, those areas, he tells them to gird up the loins of their minds. The New American Standard says gird your minds, but literally, the phrase literally is gird up the loins of your mind. And there's nothing terribly profound there other than what Peter is saying there. When he talks about girding up your loins, what he's saying there is prepare yourself, be thoughtful, be deliberate about what you do. And that's one of the main points that I want to make this morning. When he says, gird up the loins of your mind, I did some work on trying to figure out if there was anything particularly different or profound that he meant with the word that he used there for mind. There are several words in the New Testament that are translated mind or thoughts. Two or three different words, and I didn't see that there was anything particularly profound or different about the particular word that he uses here. But what I think he is saying, and what I think the New Testament writers often talk about when they use the word thoughts or mind in this context, I think what Peter is saying is that it's important for us to be deliberate and to be thoughtful about our lifestyle, about our behaviors, about our actions. See, it's our tendency to just sort of drift into things. It's our tendency to look around and see what other people are doing or saying and just do and say the same things. And it's our tendency to do the wrong thing. It's our tendency to become more thoughtless toward the people around us. It's our tendency to become unkind because, in fact, it's easier for me or it seems to somehow or other serve my purposes. So it's our tendency to behave in ways that are not good. And I think what Peter simply is saying here, and I mean, it might sound simple, might sound trite, might sound stupid in its simplicity, but Peter's simply saying, be deliberate about what you do. Think about the things that you say. Think about your actions. Think about your lifestyle. Think about your conduct. Don't just wander into things, drift into things, simply because they're there, but rather give some thought to, now how does this fit in with what God has called me to? How does this fit in to the character that he has in mind for me? How does this fit in with his character? And he'll be getting into this here in just a little bit. But that's all I think he means by gird up the loins of your mind. He's simply telling them to prepare in the area of their cognitive thought, to really prepare for things and think about them. And sounds so simple, it probably sounds stupid, but if I would really think about what I say before I say it, there'd be some benefit to that. If I would really think about the things that I do, the way I treat other people, how I spend my time, if I would really think about those things before I simply do them, there'd be some benefit to that. That's all that Peter's saying here. Gird up the loins of your mind. He tells them then to keep sober. The New American Standard supplies in spirit. I think when he tells them, and let me clarify something here also. In this verse, verse 13, he tells them to gird their minds, or gird the loins of their minds, to keep sober and to fix your hope completely on the Spirit. In reality here, there's only one command, and that's the thing that we'll be looking at the end here, when he tells them to fix their hope completely on the grace of God to come. The other things are simply observations about who we are as believers. It would perhaps be better translated, therefore girding the loins of your mind for action, therefore keeping sober. He's simply saying these are the things that are supposed to characterize who you are. And I think keeping sober just fits in with girding the loins of your mind. Don't be careless. Don't be wanton. Don't be thoughtless about what you do, about what you say, about your lifestyle and conduct. Gird the loins of your mind, keeping sober. But then what I think is most important in this verse is the way he ends the verse, with, in fact, a command when he tells them, fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. That's the most important thing for a really simple reason. And that is because no matter how much we try to gird the loins of our mind for action, no matter how much we try to keep sober, no matter how much we try to have our lifestyle, our conduct, our behaviors different and conform to the character of God and be more thoughtful in those things, no matter how much we try, it all depends simply on the grace of God. If we think we can do any of those things on our own, if we think somehow or other we have the ability in ourselves to be able to muster up the will and the willpower and the strength to do those things on our own, we are sadly mistaken, and we will be frustrated, unbelievably frustrated, if we try to do those things on our own. Rather, it is by the grace of God, it is because of Him who is willing and working in our lives, who has created us to be His workmanship for good works. It's because of what He's doing in our lives that we, in any sense, are able to do those things. So Peter puts that in there for good reason. We have to keep that in mind in this whole context. As we're talking about being holy, we cannot be holy in any sense, even in the remotest sense, apart from the grace of God. Now again, back to what I was saying earlier, I don't want to fall into one of those two traps. One trap, which is saying that it really is my behavior that defines my relationship with God, and the other trap is saying, because this isn't true, because my behavior doesn't define my relationship with God, well, then it doesn't matter. I don't want us to follow into either of those traps, but I do want us to keep in mind that none of the things that he's talking about here are remotely possible apart from the grace of God. Well, then he goes on in the next couple of verses, he goes on and tells us, as obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance. I think there's a good reason why he talks about us being children here. He talked in the introduction to 1 Peter about the Father who has foreknown us. He talks a little bit later here about if you address as Father the one who impartially judges. There really is something significant about our relationship with God the Father. There is something significant about the fact that when he makes us his children, when he makes us his sons and daughters, he really does intend that we more and more be conformed to the image of his son. We more and more begin to look like who he is. And our lives, our character begin to be transformed to look more and more like who God is. It goes without saying, I think most of us do the same thing, that when I meet people, it is very common for me to look at the children with an eye toward who their parents are, and to look at the parents with an eye toward who their children are. That's just natural. That's expected, and that's a common thing. We can see in the children at least something of who the parents are. Well, that's, I think, what Peter is getting at here. He wants us to be obedient children, and that means a couple things. That means do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance. I think what he's intending to do here is to paint a very stark contrast between the life that we used to live before we were believers and the life that we now live. Now, for someone like myself, that makes for a very interesting sort of exercise, because I was what you would say a goody two-shoes when I was growing up. Now, by that, I don't mean, at least I hope I don't mean, that I was looking down on everybody else, all that sort of thing. But I behaved a certain way. That's the reality. I didn't resent that. I wasn't frustrated by that. I wasn't unhappy with that. But I behaved a certain way as I was growing up. So if we talk about doing drugs at age 9, I didn't do it. I mean, if we talk about some of those sorts of things, you know, that just isn't my experience. But here we get back to the focus on what really is important, and that's what's going on in the heart of the individual. Because I can remember very clearly, I used to tell this story fairly often, I can remember just as clear as could be, sitting in church when I was in 8th grade, sitting in church paying very little attention to what my father had to say. He was the pastor of the church. But I do remember consciously thinking, I know that Jesus is the answer for everyone's problems. I know that that's the case, except for me. Because I fully believed, when I was in the 8th grade, I fully believed I had the key to my own life. I fully believed that my popularity at school, that my wits, my hard work, my determination, that all of those things were going to get me happily through life. Well, that is far more important than anything else that could have been going on in my life. And that's part of what, when Paul talks here about not being conformed to the former lusts, which were ours in our ignorance, it is not simply the external behaviors. It's not simply the things that we did. It is, in fact, an expression of all of who we are. Peter is telling us here, be different from who you were before. That's the plan. That's the intention. Don't be like a child anymore. Rather, as an obedient child of God the Father, be different from the way you were before. And then these strong words, but like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior, because it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Well, I talked earlier in the introduction about this word family that is used here. In this verse, it is God who is referred to as the Holy One, but then we are in the same context told to be holy. And then to add insult to injury, then in verse 16, he quotes from Leviticus when he says, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Now that quote, as I said, is from Leviticus 11. Let me find where I have it here in my notes. I know it's here. But it's from Leviticus. I think it's Leviticus 11, verse 24. But what's interesting to note in that passage in the Old Testament, if you were to look at the Septuagint, he uses the same words there that Peter used in his introduction when he talks about the fact that the children of Israel were to be consecrated, sanctified. He uses the same word that he used in chapter 1, verse 2 of 1 Peter. And I think what I took away from that is that basically God's intention for all time is that those who belong to him, whether it was pictured by the nation of Israel in the Old Testament or whether it's those who reside as aliens, believers in the New Testament, God's plan for all time is that those who belong to him be consecrated, sanctified, made holy, however you want to translate that word, because he is holy. And again, what I want to communicate, and I'm having a hard time figuring out how best to express it, is it isn't a matter of we see who God is And so we strive on our own, by our own strength, by our own will, by our own determination. We strive to be like God is because that will please God. Rather, what it is that because God is holy, it is His intention for us, and it is by His grace, and it is by His activity. He is the one who is, in fact, bringing about in our lives any holiness that we might experience. And I think that's that's what he's trying to communicate here in verses 15 and 16. And it's tied all the way back to, I think, Peter, by quoting from Leviticus, Peter is tying it all the way back to the Old Testament as well, and to what God's plan has been all along, is that we are to reflect his character, not as something that we can do on our own, but as something that he, by his grace, is doing in our lives. Well, I'm a little bit running a little bit long here, but let me just try to go through a couple of other things here before we finish up. Verse 17, if you address his father, the one who impartially judges according to each man's work. Well, I'm sorry, let me go back and just make one point in passing. Verse 15, what he says in that verse, like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all. The New American Standard supplies the word your, but we can take that out. Be holy yourselves also in all behavior. And the word that is used there has to do with conduct, lifestyle. It's a word that he uses several times throughout the book of 1 Peter. He uses it six times, actually. 1 Peter 1, verse 15, verse 18, 2, 12, 3, 1. He uses it six times, which to me suggests that Peter really is, at least to some degree in this passage, focusing on this change of behavior that he has in mind here. Chapter 1, verse 18, he talks about the fact that we were not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life. That's the same word for behavior. In chapter 2, verse 12, Peter says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. Peter really does seem to be focusing in on this as one of his main themes. And a little bit later here, he's going to make some interesting, a little bit odd comments about what that means for us. Here in verse 17, he says, if you address as father, the one who impartially judges according to each man's work, conduct yourself in fear during the time of your stay upon earth. Now, when he uses that first phrase, if you address his father, the one who impartially judges, he's talking about all of those who are believers, all of those who are chosen. We are all the ones who address as father, the one who impartially judges. So he means to include all of us when he uses that phrase. And then he says this odd thing at the end of that verse, conduct yourselves in fear. And again, the word conduct is related to the word behavior a couple of verses before. It's basically the same word, or it's from the same word. He tells us to conduct ourselves in fear during the time of our stay upon earth. And what I wanted to emphasize here is the theme that I brought up last week, and that is, for us as believers, we are in fact aliens and strangers on this earth. In fact, we do live differently. In fact, we do think differently. We act differently. That isn't something that we throw in other people's faces. That isn't something that we use to build a wall between us and other people, whether it's other people within the church or outside the church. That isn't the point. The point is simply to acknowledge that for us as believers, our conduct is different. And I think what Peter is saying here, when he says, conduct yourselves in fear, I mean, it's sort of an odd phrase. I don't think he intends that we be terrified by God, but what he does intend is that we be attentive to, respectful of who God is and of what he's doing in our lives and of what difference that makes in our lives. And he tells us in the next couple of verses, he tells us why. He says, conduct yourselves in fear because you know that you are not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life. And that futile way of life, that phrase there is related to the whole concept of conduct and behavior. You've been redeemed with, you were not redeemed with perishable things from your futile way of life that you inherited from your forefathers. Rather, it is with precious blood, as of a lamb unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ. All Peter's trying to say here is this is serious business. This is really something that we need to pay attention to. It fits in with keeping sober. It fits in with girding the loins of our mind. It fits in with what he's saying throughout this passage. God did something significant in saving us, in redeeming us. And so we're to live our lives, we're to conduct ourselves right now with some fear because of what God has done for us. And again, I don't think the intention here is that we live in terror, that we think of God as somehow or other vindictive and looking for reasons to punish us. That isn't the point at all. It is simply to point out how serious it is what God has done for us in redeeming us. Then he goes on. And it's almost as though Peter does the same sort of thing that Paul does. He mentions Christ, and then he gets off on a little bit of a tangent here in the next couple of verses, talking about Christ. Christ who was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but has appeared in these last times for the sake of you, who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. Nothing there that I think significantly adds to the argument of what he's saying there. It was an opportunity for him to talk more about who Jesus is. Important things, but I don't think it necessarily adds a lot to what he's saying in the argument here. But then he gets back in the next verse. He gets back to making some comments about who we are and about how we're to live. And here's where I think it becomes both very practical for us as well as very difficult for us to really understand what he means by this. In verse 22, Peter says, since you have in obedience to the truth, and again, you'll see these same themes come up throughout this passage and throughout 1 Peter, obedience and holiness and behavior and conduct, and you see these same themes come up, and here it is again. Since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls, and that's a part of what this obedience is all about. That's a part of the change that God brings about by his grace in the life of the believer. Since this has happened, in obedience to the truth, you purified your souls. He says, for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. Now that's where, on the one hand, it becomes very practical, because there's somebody sitting right next to you whom you can love. There's somebody sitting just down the row from you, or there's somebody that maybe isn't here this Sunday whom you can love, who has specific ways in which they need to be loved. Maybe there are physical needs that they have. Maybe there's somebody that Case and I, a friend of ours, who has not been here for months, and it might very well be because she has a child who has huge physical needs that she and her husband can barely meet on their own. Well, for us, there is a very clear path to be able to love her. So when Peter talks here about fervently loving the brethren, that for us is very, very practical, because there are things that we can do quite easily. It's so easy for us to look around and see people here that we can love in very specific ways. But on the other hand, it's kind of hard to get our arms around that, because it is so big. There is so much to that. And I think the challenge then for us is to really work at understanding, what does Peter mean by that? What does Jesus mean when he tells his disciples, greater love has no man than this, than that he lay down his life for his brother? What does Jesus mean when he tells them that his commandment to love each other is his greatest commandment? What is this business of Paul writing to the Corinthians that now abide faith, hope, love, but the greatest of these is love? That's a huge topic that would take weeks, months for us to develop, but it is something that every one of us here today, tomorrow, in the weeks and months to come, can understand at least some of what it means in our relationships with each other, as well as in our relationships outside the church. And like I said, Peter absolutely minces no words here when he says, since you have, in obedience to the truth, purified your souls for sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another. And then he builds on that in the next couple of verses, and we're going to wrap up here basically by saying that this is a part of your experience in life. This is a part of who you are, learning to love one another. It is a part of your life because you have been born again. And it is because you have been born again by a seed, not a seed that is perishable, but a seed that is imperishable. He has some discussion here of the Word of God, and I could get off on another tangent about that, but I think the thrust of what Peter's trying to say here in this article is all of these things that he's talking about, this obedience, this conduct that is different from the conduct and the lifestyle that they had before, this fervently loving one another, all of these things are a part of your life and a part of your experience because God, by his activity, through his word, has caused us to be born again. And I go back then right to the beginning of this passage, and that is all of this happens because of our need and our ability to fix our hope completely on the grace of God. That's what makes all this a possibility in our lives. Well, that's all I have to say for this morning. We've got just a couple of minutes. If anybody has some questions, I'd be happy to entertain a couple of questions. Otherwise, we are done for the day. Anybody have any questions?
There seems to be an inordinate amount of italicized words in the New American Standard Version.
Inordinate amount of italicized
words? Yeah. I mean, if I were to go through, and I have, and every time the translators have inferred a phrase or some vocabulary that they feel needs to be added, and it's italicized in the New American Standard, I have a lot of black lines, mm-hmm. a lot of black marks. Why is that?
Well, I will jump to the defense of the New American Standard translators. I don't know why. I don't know any of them, but I think that when you take out the italicized words, for the most part, it simply makes it read more clumsily than it did before, but it doesn't significantly change the meaning. In fact, in some respects, I think it makes it a little bit easier to understand. So I'm just grateful for the fact that they put words in italics if they're not there in the Greek, so that if I know the way the New American Standard works, I can go through that exercise of taking them out, or I can look at the marginal notes and see if there's a literal translation that's different. So I guess in my mind, what a stupid thing to talk about English translations as looking at the lesser of two evils or three. I mean, what a silly thing to talk about in those terms. But the New American Standard, in my mind, is certainly one of the better, perhaps the best English translation, because if they throw something in, they tell you, they put it in italics. If it's a literal rendering that's different than they have, for the most part, they tell you, and they give you clues so that you can look at it for yourself.
I have one comment and then a question.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is I didn't think that your talking about being deliberate and thoughtful about our lives was stupid at all. And I know that I didn't think it was a silly thing to say, because I just wanted to say that because that's something that, I don't know, I kind of take for granted a lot of times in talking with a lot of people, like, well, of course, like, wouldn't you think about da 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 da? Like, wouldn't you have, like, a justification for, like, why this is important to you? And I don't know, like, just the more people I interact with from, like, different ways of thinking, the more they just stare at me, like, cocking their heads, like, what are you talking about? And I think it is really easy to forget that that's a lot of work. And when you like make it a habit, it's like a really important habit, but it's a very difficult habit. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't value that because there isn't something they're working towards. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a really good thing to bring up.
Okay, thank you.
So there's that. And then my other question is, I don't know how much you can really go into this because I don't know that this is really where you're going with what you're talking about, but and I wasn't here last week. But what is your understanding of the situation into which this is being written, like who he's writing to? Because I think it makes sense to say, well, he's talking about all believers, so this is applicable to us. But I didn't know kind of where you saw him writing to originally.
It's written to a part of what was the Roman Empire that in many respects, Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, those areas, the areas that he talks about in verse 1, that in many respects were a little bit off the beaten path, although there were some main trade routes from Asia that went through there, but it wasn't really quite the center certainly wasn't the center of the Roman Empire at the time. But there was some question that we talked about last week about whether it's written to Jewish Christians or to Jewish and Gentile Christians. I think it was written to both Jewish and Gentile Christians, and that a lot of the references to Gentiles are specifically in the context of, as a Gentile, you live this way, now live this way. Whereas for the Jews, there certainly was, as we see throughout the New Testament, especially in Acts, there certainly was a sense that when it came to morality, they had it down. They understood what they had to do to attain God's favor. Well, Jesus certainly, and I would say Peter and Paul also poked a lot of holes in that and pointed out the fallacy of thinking that that their set of morality, their belief system, was in fact what caused God to look upon them favorably. So as we go through this book, it seems to me to be addressed maybe a little bit more toward Gentiles, or at least toward those Jewish believers, Jewish Christians, who were outside of Jerusalem. And I think that when you get to the synagogues and the Jews who were outside of Jerusalem, they certainly were far more influenced by a pagan culture and by different lifestyles than were the Jews in Jerusalem and right around Jerusalem. So I guess I would say that the book was written more toward folks who would have much more experience with all of the excesses and all of the behaviors of a pagan Gentile culture. Whether they were Jews or whether they were Gentiles who were converted, they were in the midst of a culture that would have been characterized by those things.
And what was the position of Peter in relation to these churches that he was writing to? Do you know if there was, is there any hint of like, there was a specific problem that he was addressing, or like he was just like, I'm going to write a letter?
Well, that's not clear, and I don't have a good answer to that because okay. It isn't clear. It isn't clear that he visited these churches even. I mean, we don't know if he spent any time to speak of in these churches, or just exactly what the occasion was for his letter. So at least I don't have much more historical background than that as I was looking for it. So anybody else? Any other questions or comments before we wrap up for the day? Back in the back, Margaret.
I always get nervous when I hear the word fear, you know, regarding God with fear. That's something I do kind of naturally, but I'm not sure when I think about fear in the sense of being terrified, I'm not sure it's my most productive time with God when that's the mode that I'm in. So I've always liked the, we have not received, in Romans, is it? We haven't received a spirit of fear, but a spirit of whatever that is by which we cry out to God, Father. So I'm wondering if the word fear, if you just offhand know, is the word fear that Peter uses here the same word for fear or related to the word fear that Paul is using in Romans?
I don't know. I mean, the word that is used here is the very commonly word, or very common word from which we get the word phobia. I mean, that's the word that's used here. I'm not sure which word Paul uses, but it certainly is probably the most common word in the New Testament for fear.
I'd be interested in sometime.
Pardon?
You.
It's the same word Jack says.
Okay. I'd be interested in somebody, you or somebody else, talking more about the fear, you know, in what sense should we fear God, and in what sense do we not have a spirit of fear, mm-hmm. the contrast there sometime.
But yeah, I, it would have been good for me to have elaborated on that some, because it really, I mean, I'm not sure that I could, off the top of my head, clear up the confusion, but it is not... I don't think that Peter has in mind here the craven fear that comes from feeling guilty all the time, that comes from, as you and I have talked, that comes from the sort of experience, that the sort of church background and experience that you had growing up and that so many others had. I don't think that is at all what he has in mind here, as much as a sense of respect and seriousness, taking seriously who God is and what he's done. But I could use a lot more elaboration, certainly. Anybody else? Are we done? All right. Well, thank you all. See you next week.